Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today on The Charlie Kirk Show, we sit down with the great Rand Paul for a fascinating and wide-ranging conversation with the senator starting with how to bring an end to America's perpetual foreign wars. Rousseauian democracy versus the founders, republicanism, our skyrocketing national debt, climate change, and last but not least, the state of the president's golf game. Before we go any further, please give us that subscribe, give us a 5-star rating. We're surging in the charts. We are just so honored by all of your support and blown away by it. Give us a subscribe. This is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show, home of conservative, libertarian, rational thinking. Here we go. This episode is brought to you exclusively by our great sponsors, BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbooks experts. College football is back, everybody. College football is back. There is nothing better than seeing college football on a Saturday. There's something so uniquely American, something so patriotic about college football. Miami versus Florida. I don't have a gator in that hunt. Get it? But I just can't wait to see college football be back. For those of you that may or may not know, I'm a huge Oregon Ducks fan. My dad, my uncle, my aunt all went to the University of Oregon. So go Ducks, go. They're going to win the national championship just like the Bears are going to the Super Bowl and the Cubs are going to the World Series. If you actually want to get engaged and get involved in wagering on your favorite team, and that's only one place that has you covered, betonline.ag. You got to do this right now. You have to sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use that promo code podcast1 for your 50% welcome bonus. I mean, you got so many things happening, so many questions, whether the Patriots will win another Super Bowl. Tom Brady is phenomenal. And if you want to get involved, go to betonline.ag, sign up today for a free account, use that promo code podcast1. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore, get on the action. Don't forget to use that promo code podcast1 or text BETNOW, that's BETNOW 238-669, to receive a 50% welcome bonus. Betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts. So before we get right into it, I just want to say how honored we are to have Senator Rand Paul take time out of his busy schedule to come speak at our Turning Point USA Teenage Student Action Summit, tpusa.com. If anyone listening to this wants to get engaged or get involved, please get involved with Turning Point USA and the work that we are doing on high school and college campuses all across the country. We had a packed room of 1,500 high schoolers from all 50 states. They were so excited to hear from the president, to hear from Don Jr., and yes, Senator Rand Paul. I think Senator Rand Paul is one of the best, if not the best, senator that we have in Congress, if not the best elected official. He is principled. He is fearless. He is courageous. He understands the implications of a growing nanny state government. And I'm just such an admirer of his worldview and his capacity to fight for his values. And it was one of the great honors to be able to sit down with him and have him here on the Charlie Kirk Show. And there's very little we disagree on, and you'll see that, especially his critique of some of our endless foreign wars, his understanding of the philosophy that built the greatest country ever to exist in the history of the world. Senator Rand Paul is a total and complete hero. And when I say that we here at the Charlie Kirk Show are the home of the intersection of conservative libertarian thinking, I think of Rand Paul. I think of Rand Paul, who is fearless in his libertarian beliefs, but also is very embracing of conservatives as well. And so enjoy this conversation with none other than Senator Rand Paul. Please give us that 5-star rating. Please leave a review, press subscribe, and get your friend to do the same. Without any further ado, here we go. Senator Rand Paul, live from the Turning Point USA Teenage Student Action Summit, one-on-one with yours truly. Here we go. Busy day on Capitol Hill today.
Well, you know, at least we got the comfortable chairs, you know. I said, I'm not coming unless there's comfortable chairs. So,
on this very busy day, we thank you for coming out to the largest ever teenage conservative summit held. So, Bob Mueller testifying.
Don't get me started.
But, no, please get started on it.
Here's the thing, all right, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a doctor, but I know that American jurisprudence, our system, is based on what? Innocent until proven guilty. Now, Mueller's supposed to be this smart lawyer, but he doesn't seem to understand the fundamental part of our judicial system. So he writes in his report, well, I can't exonerate him. I cannot tell you that he's innocent. That's never the job of a prosecutor. A prosecutor never does that. You either prove guilt or the presumption is of innocence. That small point, nobody asked that in committee. It's like, are we not presumed to be innocent? And you don't get, think about what world you would. If everybody in here had to prove that you were innocent of a crime that happened around the corner. You don't prove your innocence. Someone has to prove your guilt. The burden is on the government, not on the individual. This is an amazing thing about our country.
It is a intentional regression. And this is what, I mean, in China, if you're accused of something, you have to prove your innocence.
Exactly.
And what has made common law so effective throughout the last couple hundred years is the burden of proof is on the individual who's being accused. And it would actually be metaphysically impossible to prove your innocence in this case.
Right. And I think the thing about it is, I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's sort of one of the dividing lines or things that separates us, a freedom society, from a totalitarian society, is the presumption of innocence. Because the presumption is that the government has to prove something, that there's a burden upon the government, that you're presumed to have your freedom. And it's just like your rights, things that they take away from you. You're presumed to have these freedoms. And when you look at the Bill of Rights, the Ninth Amendment says, you know, not to disparage those rights that aren't mentioned. It's not a complete list, but don't disparage because you have a plentiful aspect of rights. Most of these rights, or all of them really, they come from your creator. They're not something the government grants you.
Senator, that's a great point. Made me think of something that a lot of these students hear a lot of, and maybe you could help equip them with the proper response, because the left makes it seem as if things that are not naturally given by God should be rights, such as health care, such as housing. You being a doctor, right, who actually has worked in the medical field, what is the correct response when the left says, well, health care is a human right and should be treated as such?
I had this discussion with Bernie Sanders, all right? I don't think he got it. So Bernie was in the committee, and he was going off, well, health care is a right, and this and that. And I said, what, you believe in slavery? I said, I'm a doctor. There are nurses there. There's the custodian. There's the hospital administrator. They all work in the hospital. You have a right to their labor? You have a right just to take it? Everybody's supposed to give you their labor? That's slavery. And they're like, but there's another aspect to this, and you can't end with that because you'll never get to the conclusion of the argument. We also have obligations. So I'm a Christian. I believe that we are obligated to help. We are our brother's keeper. The government doesn't tell me that. My religion tells me that, and I choose that.
And the basis of the argument right now versus the radical left and constitutionalists like yourself is they do not believe in the natural right theory, or if you will, or the reality from the Scottish Enlightenment. They believe in something more, much more Rousseauian, which is that it's government that actually grants us our existence, social contract theory, if you will. And for all of our students out there, understanding this is the basis and the philosophical divergence that we have with the left. So you recently, sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's a good point with Rousseau, because you either get your rights natural and they're yours and you own them, they're intrinsically, they're inherent to you, or the majority gives them to you. And so Rousseau was a big believer in democracy. But here's the problem with democracy. And anytime people tell you, oh, we're going to go to war for democracy and all this, remind them, we're not a democracy, we're a republic. And also remind them that there have been times when the majority does the wrong thing. And I'll give you a couple of examples. The Jim Crow laws. They were passed by majorities in the South. And don't let them tell you it was Republicans. They were all Democrats, every damn one of them. But they made these laws because they believed that the majority, the power of the majority, could run roughshod over a minority. And there's a great line in Martin Luther King's A Letter from the Birmingham Jail where he says that an unjust law is a law where the numerical majority imposes something on the minority but does not make it binding on themselves. That's sort of the definition of a bad law. It has to apply to everybody equally. You can't say there's a law for whites and a law for blacks. But Martin Luther King got it. But we need to be reminded that majorities are not always right, and you don't want a majority taking away your right to own a gun or where you go to church or who you associate with.
And
Many of our students are faced with this because they will come across left-wing teachers or professors, activists,
a few of them,
that will say, well, we are a democracy, and you see almost every Democrat running for president use this language, and the media never stops them and says, no, we're a constitutional republic. It's a fundamental difference. And I would actually say most Republicans don't even call this out.
I agree. And this is a real tragedy. That's the number one question I ask kids whenever I meet them from third grade up. Every high school kid, junior high kid, grade school kid, I say, who knows in the audience? Are we a democracy or republic? Because it makes a big difference. Majority rule is not a good thing. The thing is that your rights are from God. They're inherent, but they can't be taken away from by a majority. They're yours. They pre-exist government, but you don't want a government big enough to take away your rights. You want a government so small you can barely see it, and a government that largely leaves you alone.
So, Senator, you recently golfed with the President of the United States. Who won?
I can't remember if that's top secret or not.
Yeah, it might be classified, right?
No, the President, I love playing with the President. He's a good golfer. The first time I played with him before he was President, I was actually hitting him up for some money because I was going on a mission trip. I do eye surgery. I was going to Guatemala, and so we asked him for some money, and he gave some money to contribute to the trip. And he shot even par that day. Had like 10 birdie putts. Now, since then, I don't think I've seen a game quite that good. But we had a great match about a week ago. President and I were on one team, and David Perdue, the senator from Georgia. And we're playing Lindsey Graham and the club pro. So sort of good versus evil, kind of. But anyway, we were tied going into the 18th hole. And I'm an average golfer, but I love playing, and I never give up, which is a good, you know, philosophy of life. I don't ever give up. So I hit the worst drive. I'm in the rough, and I have 188 yards. I nailed it. I'm on the green. I two-putt for par, and I tie the pro. And the president says, let's play sudden death. So we go to the first hole, and the pro pars it again. David Perdue pars it. We go to the 18th hole again. I hit an even worse drive. I'm shortest, and I'm so far over, nobody even knows I'm still playing. I'm behind two giant maple trees, but I hit the best shot of my entire life. It explodes through the top of the tree, lands 5 feet from the pin, and I make the birdie putt to win the round.
So from what you're
That was the president and I winning together. Didn't beat the president. We were on the same team.
Well, so. He is a winner. So are you. So what you can share, how is he, you know, in those kind of moments as you've gotten to know him?
I think the president is almost identical in public to the way he is in private. He is interesting, he's engaging, and he's fun to be around, actually. And it's one of the things that has perplexed the media because they hate him. They hate him so much in the media. They just froth. They're like drooling. They hate the president so much. Many of them, you know, threatened to leave the country. I think it was John Stewart said he was going to leave the country. He's still here. What's he still doing here? Why doesn't he leave? But the one thing they don't get about him, and the one thing I think that's extraordinary about the president, it's extraordinary about anybody who finally wins sort of the biggest job in the country, is that here's a guy who's been wealthy his whole life, wealthier than most of us will ever even dream of being. He's a billionaire. And yet he connects with the common guy, with the working man, with the guy making cars that he's been trying to have more cars made in the U.S. He really does connect, and he's done great at getting votes that no other Republicans were able to get before.
It's extraordinary. And I think one of the things that you and the president have really linked on a policy perspective, and something I know I agree with completely, is being skeptical and critical of these endless wars in the Middle East. And in this audience, there are 14 and 15-year-olds that have not been alive during a time that the United States was not occupying Afghanistan. I hesitate to even call it a war because there was not an official declaration of war.
Right.
You can correct me if I'm wrong there. But this generation knows nothing but endless conflict in a place that they'll probably never visit, that doesn't affect our national sovereignty or security, but we're spending hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of dollars.
President Trump is extraordinary on this. We haven't had a Republican in my lifetime that really is this extraordinary. In his State of the Union address, remember, there were two lines that really struck me that were just amazing. One, America will never, ever be a socialist nation. And the other line he said was that, you know, great nations don't fight perpetual wars. And I agree completely with that. When we separated from England, there were a lot of good things we brought with us. One was the resistance to central authority. The British had been fighting against the king to limit the king's power for 400 or 500 years. Really, in some ways, we're a continuation of that. We were tired of their king also, but we also set our government up to have a president that didn't have that much power. We wanted the president to be checked and balanced by the Congress. Madison put it this way. He said we would separate the powers, and then we would have ambition check ambition. The ambition of a senator or a congressman to try to gain power would be checked by both the judiciary and the president, and vice versa. Particularly with war, Europe was just constant war for hundreds of years. All the kings and queens were related to each other. They were always fighting. The common man was fighting the wars. Nobody knew what these squabbles were about. They were petty squabbles over lands and kingdoms and duchies and all of this. So we set ours up. And what did we say? In our Constitution, it says very clearly, Congress shall declare war. Only Congress shall declare war. And then some people say, oh, gosh, Congress is terrible. They're feckless. They could never do anything. Think about our history. When we were attacked on December 7th, 1941, on December 8th, FDR came before a joint session like this, talked to the joint house, and said, we've been attacked by Japan, and I ask you to declare war. What was the vote? Like 432-1 or something. So we can unify when we're attacked. George W. Bush did the same thing when we were attacked on 9/11. He came before the House, and he said, there's evidence that this was organized and originated in Afghanistan. The vote was virtually unanimous. Now, there have been other times when it hasn't been as unanimous, and this is something I really agree with the president on. When the Iraq War came, our country was very divided on whether it was a good idea. It also got us involved in two wars at one time, and it turns out, really, Iraq had no connection to 9/11. It just became another war. But my big complaint about it, and I think the president agrees with me on this, is that every time we topple a strong man in the Middle East, which is about all they've ever known, we get chaos. And out of the chaos, we get more terrorists. Sometimes we get organized terrorists like ISIS. They come from that vacuum. It happened when we got rid of Saddam Hussein, which was a counterbalance to Iran. Now Iran is stronger because there is no Iraq. In fact, Iraq is allied with Iran now. When we got rid of Gaddafi, once again, no great statesman. But when we get rid of him, what happens? Chaos, more terrorism. There's this huge civil war still going on in Libya. So really, we need to think about it. And from my point of view, I think about it. I've got three boys. They're young and of military age. I've got three nephews serving in the military. I think about it. What does it take for me to send them to war? It has to be something pretty significant. Right now, there is no mission in Afghanistan. We've been there 19 years. We're doing nation building. And the president, if he were sitting here, would say exactly the same thing. We're spending $50 billion a year over there that could be much better spent here.
And our, as a country, we have a horrible track record in dictator replacement. I mean, a lot of the Iranian conflict was because of a CIA failure. Then we should never have overthrown Mossadegh and put the Shah back in power. That sowed huge seeds of resentment, and the Central Intelligence Agency denied it up until recently.
It's one mistake, pyramids upon another mistake, which pyramids upon another. And everything is a reaction to something that happened before. And so what I always jokingly say to the neoconservatives that want war everywhere and think we're going to make the world perfect, oh, we're going to go to Libya, we're going to get rid of Gaddafi, and they're going to elect Thomas Jefferson. It's like, Thomas Jefferson doesn't live in Libya, okay? And it's not, and I don't mean that to be a slam to their country or anything. We have a tradition. It's not an accident about where we are. In 1215, the barons gathered at Runnymede to tell the king, we're taking some of your power. And they took a little bit over time. They fought back and forth for hundreds of years. They have their glorious rebellion in 1688, and they have their Bill of Rights at that time. About 100 years later, we separate and do the same sort of thing. It's a continuation of wanting to limit the power of the central authority, whether it's a president or a king or anybody else, whether it's one you like or dislike. So I've been one, actually, who, even though I'm a huge fan of the president and I'm friends with the president, still say, Mr. President, we're not giving you the spending authority. So there is still this push back and forth, and there needs to be. Each branch of the House, as well as the president, should guard that power to try to make sure it doesn't accumulate too much of it in one place.
And when the abuse of the War Powers Act that was passed in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken, has put us in endless conflict after endless conflict. And it's this generation, it's this audience that not only has to go out and fight these wars, but then pay for the wars through the deficit spending and the accumulating debt. Senator, when I first became a fan of yours, I believe you came in the class of 2010, right? The Tea Party wave. I think our national debt was $9 trillion, maybe $8
trillion. Those were the good old days.
Right?
Yeah. Only $9 or $10 trillion
back then. Now it's $22 trillion.
Now, it's a scandal. So when George Bush was elected in 2000, it was $5 trillion. When he finished, it was about $10 trillion. When President Obama was elected, it was $10. It was about $20 when he finished. But right now, it's getting ready to explode. There's going to be a debt deal next week, and I'm very much opposed to it. It says the debt ceiling, which is the limit on how much we can borrow, will be taken off completely. There'll be no limit to the debt ceiling. There's only a date. It says after the election in 2020, we'll come back and address how much we borrowed, and we'll just that'll be the new debt limit, and then we'll start again. They're also, when we were elected in the Tea Party sort of tidal wave of 2010, we elected like, I think, 90 new Republican congressmen, 6 new Republican senators. We put caps on spending. And the caps, actually, and this is where the media is so dishonest. The media said, oh, they're draconian cuts, and everybody will be homeless, and there'll be no money, and we won't be helping the poor. There were a slowdown in the rate of growth of spending. And this is always true. This is one fact you need to get about the media. They will lie to you about this. So recently, President Trump put out something on Medicare, and the media said he's going to cut $5 trillion from Medicare. Here's the truth of it. Spending's on a baseline rising every day, and over the next 10 years, Medicare is going to go up 110%. Trump's budget was going to make it go up 88%, and they call that a cut. It's a cut from a projected increase. It's not a cut from dollar. So when I have proposed the penny plan, that's a real cut. That's the only real cut you'll ever hear of. But it's only one penny. If you cut one penny out of every dollar of spending, you actually balance the budget within about 5 years.
And so the significance of this is that in normal life and in normal business and how all of you budget, if you think you're getting a $1 cut, you say, I spent I spent a dollar last year, I'll spend 99 cents. In D.C., you get a 1 cent cut, you spend $1.09. It's just
exactly.
A cut in how much you're increasing.
Right. And sort of this is the battle we have, and our message in our battle is a more difficult one. Because which message do you think is easier, to be, oh, I'm for Santa Claus, or I'm for hard work and budgeting? You know, our message is always more difficult. But I think we have the argument that freedom, leaving people alone, creates great wealth. And this is sort of the comparison you have to tell your friends is that look at America and look how the poor live in America versus the poor in another country. Look at our country versus Venezuela. Look at what happens under socialism. A good definition of socialism is you know it's going really well when people begin to eat their pets and they've lost 20 pounds without trying. Socialism's a disaster.
And also, this episode is brought to you exclusively by our great sponsors, BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts. Oh my goodness, this weekend is the start of one of the great American institutions. I cannot wait to watch it. I'll be with some of my buddies. College football, Miami versus Florida. And there's only one place that has you covered if you actually want to get engaged and get involved in wagering on your favorite team, and that's BetOnline.ag. You got to do this right now. You have to sign up today for a free account at BetOnline.ag and use that promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. Get on the action. Don't forget to use that promo code PODCAST1 or text BETNOW, that's BETNOW 238-669, to receive a 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts.
It's our generation that is the one that is pushing this decline towards socialism, or at least the ideological decline. And it seems as if that there's not enough of a proper argument to refute that. And that's a terrific way to do it. And the left is using the channels of communication and culture in academia and on college campuses and in pop culture to make it seem as if this has never been tried before.
Right.
As if this is some sort of new invention that we've never had, despite it being tried 100 times over the last 100 years, resulting in 100 million people killed.
Right. Well, we have a book coming out in the fall. My wife and I have a book called The Case Against Socialism. And one of the premises of it is that there isn't a kinder, gentler socialism. That socialism inherently involves state violence, and actually socialism actually picks out for ruthless people. Hayek wrote about this, and he said, it's not an accident that you get Stalin or Hitler. It's good to remember that Hitler was a socialist also. Stalin, Hitler, Mao, Pol Pot, and the others. Why did they turn out to be so ruthless? And Hayek put it this way. He said, well, it's a selection phenomenon. If you want a little bit of socialism, you don't have to beat as many people up. You don't have to put as many people in jail. But if I ultimately want to come and take your house, and I want to take your car, your bike, everything you own, I want to take all of your possessions, who's going to be best at that? Somebody who's sort of easygoing and nice, or someone who's ruthless and will put you in a concentration camp or put you in a gas chamber? Ruthlessness is selected for when you want to take and have government ownership of property. So Stalin wasn't an accident. Hitler wasn't an accident. If you believe that the collective should run things and that you don't individually have your own God-given rights and that the collective or the majority of the collective can decide what to do with you and your possessions, ultimately it'll lead to ruthlessness and violence. And it's also part of the same thing that's a little more subtle, because now you have AOC saying, oh, well, we're not right now. We kind of are for employee ownership and government ownership of something, but really we're just for fairness. You know, it's just unfair, you know, that some people have more money than others and people are getting richer. Here's a great website you should look at. It's called humanprogress.org. And on it, it talks about in the year 1800, 90% of the world lived in extreme poverty, less than $2 a day. When I was born in the 60s, it was down to a third. We went from 90% in extreme poverty to a third because of what Adam Smith talked about, trade, division of labor, capitalism, and a marketplace. Now, I'm 56 years old. We've gone from a third of the people in extreme poverty to less than 10%. The world's getting better. Everywhere around you, it looks like it's coming up.
And if you visit Human Progress, I think it's .net or .org,
yeah,
you'll find information such as the world has never been greener, believe it or not, and this is something that the media will never report to you.
The air's never been cleaner.
That's right.
These are EPA statistics. They measure six pollutants. Every one of them are at their lowest level they've been in 70 years. Now they say, well, CO2's a pollutant. But you know who the big polluters are if CO2's a pollutant? All you breathers out there, if you quit breathing, we wouldn't have so much CO2. That's why, and these people are nuts. These people are completely crazy. There's a woman up in Canada, and she wants to have a planetary law, whatever the heck that is, a planetary law of one child per person because we got too many breathers, too many people breathing, too many cows, too many people. These people are nuts, and push back on it and read for yourself because climate does change for a lot of reasons, but one of the main reasons are planetary reasons and orbital reasons. And a guy named Milankovitch talked about this in the 1920s. It has to do with the tilt of the Earth, the wobble of the tilt, and the eccentricity of the orbit of the Earth. There are explanations for a lot of this, but in all likelihood, we're going to be entering a cooling stage as we have for the last several million years.
Well, isn't it amazing, Senator? I wish I could advocate for something that is impossible to prove in the scientific method, but no matter what happens, it proves your thesis because your thesis is unpredictability.
Right.
So things get hotter, it proves your thesis. Things get colder because right. They say there's just change happening.
The thing that's so backwards about it is they try to beat you up at a consensus. All scientists, 97% of all scientists.
97% of scientists. Who's heard this before?
Right.
Yeah, okay, so talk about that, Senator.
Here's the problem with it is, it defies the scientific method. The scientific method is to be skeptical. Einstein was skeptical of Newton. Newton was skeptical of Copernicus and Galileo. Science is built upon skepticism. You're always trying to refute or prove something through experimentation. So for them to say CO2 might be causing global warming, I'm not going to say it isn't, but here's what they need to prove. The world has warmed and cooled over 100,000 year cycles for many millions of years. On average, we're cold for about 80,000 years and we're warm for about 10 or 20,000 years. We're somewhere in that now. But let's say it's been getting warmer for 40 years. What is 40 years divided into 100,000? It's a very small number. So is it enough of a statistical sample to make projections on 100,000 years what's going to happen? No, you can have a curve that's coming down and takes a little blip up. But the bottom line is consensus is not what scientists is about. Science is always about skepticism. It's always about experimentation and proving your point. And there's a lot of contradictory. There's a plaque up in one of these parks near a glacier saying, come and see it now because it'll be gone by 2020. They're having to take the plaque down now because the glacier's bigger. And as
well, and it seems, so I do have to ask, Senator, I'm guessing you didn't vote for the Green New Deal. 57-0.
No.
Amazing how when you actually call their bluff, they're not actually willing to vote for it.
We talk about it a little bit in the case against socialism because it's an aspect of socialism, basically. And if you look through the global warming alarmists and you read their comments, a lot of them will ultimately say, and we have several of these quotes in the book where they say, well, it's not really all about global warming. It's really about redistributing the wealth. We got these rich countries that have soaked up all the wealth, and we realize that China and India and the other countries are going to have to pollute more, but we're going to have to absorb all of the losses. And here's the thing. All of these accords let all of these other poor countries pollute like heck. You know where the pollution's coming from? It's coming from China and India and all these developing nations. It's not coming from here. In fact, even if you are concerned with the carbon footprint, ours is going down. And the thing is that they want us to absorb it, though, because they think we're too rich and we need to transfer our wealth to those other countries. So we need to limit our industrial output to let these other countries fill in their industrial output.
And it seems as if they're using the environmental issue, which resonates with people because individuals do love the environment, as they should, as a means to get more control. It seems as if this is a instrument to get more control over our business, our livelihood, our actions, and our freedoms.
Right. And I think we shouldn't give them the high moral ground on this. Look, I love the environment as much as anybody. I'm a huge fan of trees. I try to grow redwood trees. I got cherry trees. I got all kinds of different trees I try to grow in my yard. And the thing is that I like the term crunchy con. You know, can you not be for the environment and be conservative at the same time?
And it seems as if the left makes it seem as if they're the only ones that care about the environment. So kind of going back to one of the things we talked about earlier in foreign policy, you introduced a bill recently, last couple of weeks, maybe last month, to actually stop funding some of these external countries where these arms end up in the hands of not so good actors.
Right.
I don't know how it performed in the Senate, but it seems such common sense that we shouldn't be selling advanced weaponry to countries
right.
that end up doing deals with ISIS.
Yeah. So I've been a big critic of Saudi Arabia. Everybody talks about Iran, and I'm not saying Iran's a great place, but everybody says, oh, Iran is the largest state sponsor of terrorism. Well, maybe, but actually, I think Saudi Arabia is a bigger spawn of radical jihad and Islam around the world. Over the past decade, the Saudis have spent $100 billion spreading their form of Islam around the world. And I'll give you a couple of examples. 10 years ago, there were a couple thousand madrasas, these religious schools in Pakistan. There's now like somewhere between 20 and 30,000 of them. In one particular school, funded by the Saudis, in one particular school, 80% of the graduates join the Taliban and fight against Americans, all funded by the Saudis, and yet we still give them weapons. They killed Khashoggi, a dissident, chopped him up in a brutal fashion in a consulate. They're fighting a war against the poorest nation in the world, Yemen, and we've been assisting them with that. So really, I think we need to think about it. We need to think about it not just that Iran is a problem, but that so is Saudi Arabia. And the thing is that if we want Iran to behave and not have ballistic missiles, which everybody says, oh, the nuclear deal wasn't good enough, we have to get them to quit making ballistic missiles. Well, when do you think they're going to stop? Only if they had a deal where Saudi Arabia would slow down at the same time. It would be sort of like asking the U.S. to get rid of missiles, but you know, Russia's not going to do it at all. When we finally did reduce missiles, and it was under Reagan and Gorbachev, we both did it. So Iran's only going to get rid of their ballistic missiles if we tell Saudi Arabia they need to work together in a multilateral or a bilateral agreement, and we're just not getting there because we're not thinking through the situation. But I think Saudi Arabia, when you look at what they've done in the area and the spreading of hatred of Jews and Christians and Hindus, frankly, throughout the world, that we really shouldn't be giving them weapons, that we shouldn't give them nuclear technology. You think they're going to promise to use it for nuclear energy and not, you know, take that knowledge and potentially create nuclear weapons? So I think we ought to be very, very careful with who we give weapons to.
I totally agree. It ends up in the hands of people that are then fighting Americans.
Right.
Does the exact opposite.
We still fight our own weapons all the time. So, for example, at one point, ISIS had $1 billion worth of Humvees, U.S. Humvees. The other day, I read that United Arab Emirates had $170,000 anti-tank missiles from the U.S. that they've given to people in Libya. when we have altercations with Iran, Iran still has weapons that we gave to the Shah back in the 70s. We have weapons everywhere over there, and I'm just not so sure that we should just keep giving them to everybody. So when we were over there fighting in Syria, Syria's a mess like every other place. Is Assad perfect? No, he's kind of like Gaddafi or Hussein or any of these other iron-fisted people. Not a whole lot of rights. You probably wouldn't want to live there. And yet, the people on the other side are jihadists. They're allied with Saudi Arabia, but they're also allied with, many of them, directly with al-Qaeda. So there's a group called al-Nusra. And we said, well, we're a little skittish about this group, but we give weapons to Qatar and to Saudi Arabia, and they both plowed them into Syria, giving them to these people, including ISIS. And then we have to go back to fight ISIS. It's one thing after another.
And your bill is to suspend arms sales to all these countries.
Yeah, what I would say is we have a bill, and this sounds like tongue-in-cheek, but no arming of terrorist nations.
And this is so important because you also have been critical of funding countries that burn the American flag. And what do we spend in foreign aid a year? I mean, it's in the billions.
It's about $30 billion. And every year I put in something. So every time there's a new bill that comes up and says, oh, we're going to spend $15 billion on this, I say, well, why don't we take it from the foreign aid account? And if we're going to spend it maybe here in this country. But it's really bad. I mean, the stuff we spend it on, we have one program where we spend money to bring kids from Pakistan to send them to space camp over here. And it's just, you know, the money. We have one program that I tried to get rid of recently, $290 million to train foreign countries how to write grants to get more money from us. We spent $300,000 studying Japanese quail to see if they're more sexually promiscuous on cocaine.
So
we could have polled the audience, maybe, right, and asked that question.
What was the?
Yeah, really.
Yeah,
I think you can just assume the what the findings were. Here's another
one. Interested.
$2 million to find out: are you more or less likely to eat food if somebody in front of you in the cafeteria line sneezed on the food?
I would say less likely.
I'm thinking you're right. But
save $2 billion.
Yeah, but we just keep doing this. And here's the thing about it, and this is what's frustrating about it for those of us who watch this. When I was a kid, William Proxmire was a conservative Democrat, and he gave out something called the Golden Fleece Award for waste to try to draw attention to waste. So like one of his first ones was $50,000 spent trying to discover what makes people happy. All right, if you want to do that on your own nickel, go ahead. But, you know, I mean, the taxpayer paying for that, that's ridiculous. But it all comes from, a lot of these behavioral studies come from the National Science Foundation. But through the years, has their budget ever been cut? No, it goes up. And so a lot of people make the mistake, and McCain used to frankly make this mistake. McCain would talk about waste in the military, but he always wanted to increase their budget by 10%. My point is this. If I gave you $100 last year and you were wasteful with it, if I give you $110 this year, you're going to be more or less wasteful. The only way you can't make rules to make people better at waste. You give them less money, and they're like, oh, my goodness, we've got to conserve the money because we got less money. Or give them the same. At the very least, give them the same, but don't give them more.
Well, and there was an example in Afghanistan, and you know these details better than anyone else. I remember you mentioning this. We spent something like $90 million on a hotel across the street from our embassy that has 7,000 people in it. The hotel's not finished. The shell of a hotel. And someone ran with the money to Jordan or something. They fled.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And then it's now it's a Taliban outpost where they shoot down at our embassy.
And
now we have to deconstruct.
And you know what the conclusion is going to be to this hotel? We're going to spend another couple hundred thousand to tear it down because it's a danger to our soldiers.
So
some guy got $90 million and ran off with it. There's another example from Afghanistan. They wanted to build a gas station for the Afghans. See, it's not about war. It's about building stuff for them. So, but because we're going green in the military, it's a natural gas station. How many people have a car in the audience that runs on natural gas? Nobody in America has a car that runs on natural gas. They're extraordinary if they exist. Nobody in Afghanistan even has a car. The average income is $800 a year. So nobody's got a car. They're burning campfires, all right? And so we built them a natural gas station. They had no cars, so we bought them some cars. We bought them 24 cars that run on natural gas, but they had no money, so we gave them a credit card to get the gas. But the gas station was supposed to cost about $500,000. It ended up costing $45 million because the contractors were ripping us off. So I had two members of my staff that said they'd go to Afghanistan to look at some of this waste. They got over there, and after 19 years, you can't drive in a car anywhere. You have to go by helicopter with Marines to protect you, even within the city of Kabul, the capital. So the gas station was out in the country, and they said, can we see it to see if it is functioning? What's a $45 million natural gas station doing? And they said, well, we just can't take the risk to go out there. It's not worth Americans dying to show you this gas station. So it's like, we spent $45 million in an area of the country we can't even visit? See, this is crazy. No kids should be sent over to Afghanistan when there is no reason for the war anymore. We're building them gas stations and roads.
Well, Senator, our time is short. Is there anything in particular you wanted to plug? I know you mentioned the book, and everyone here should buy the book, The Case Against Socialism. Is it available for pre-order yet, or it will be soon?
Soon. It's going to come out end of September, early October.
Well, this room can help make it a bestseller. I know that. But is there anything else that these students can help you with in your fight for liberty? And I have to tell everyone in this audience, I've dealt with so many of these politicians, and they just don't get it. I mean, there's maybe four or five in the Senate that reasonably get it. And really, Senator Rand Paul is one of the few that is so vocal on the issue of ending the endless wars and criticizing the spending. So how can these students help you in your fight for the Constitution and liberty?
If you're interested in politics, when you get into college, internships, almost everybody has internships up here. They're, I think, intriguing to do in the summer. You can do them during the school year, too, but in the summer. We have a program where we invite speakers in. And, in fact, if there's any time you have people up here when we're having a speaker, we'd love to have your kids that are up here for something invited to hear some of our speakers. But that's one way you can get involved. The other thing is it's not, you know, some of you will run for office, and that's great. But it always doesn't have to be that, too. You can be the guy or the woman who goes out and makes a great living and helps other people as well. You can be involved in politics in a lot of different ways. But even if you say, oh, I'm going to run for office, I really want to run for office, my suggestion usually is do something first. Work, have a career.
So don't be a professional politician. Well, It's such an honor to have this lineup of speakers, and I couldn't think of anyone else better than Senator Rand Paul to articulate the values that we all stand for. So let's thank him again. Thank you, Senator.
What a great conversation that was with Senator Rand Paul. Just so honored that he was able to take that time. And thank you, Senator, for that. We have your back in your fight for liberty, your fight to end the endless wars, and your fight to reduce and shrink the size and scope of government, and every day fighting for the United States Constitution. And please give us those 5-star ratings, leave a review, support our sponsors. Again, this is Charlie Kirk, host of The Charlie Kirk Show, your home for rational, conservative, libertarian thinking.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest.